Accession number 11938, reel 17.
Reel 17. When did you embark at Goorock, Mr. Iston?
Well, I don't remember the time of day exactly, but I think it was dusk time before we actually got on. I don't know how I can describe this. If you can imagine a railway station, a platform of a long railway station, except that having railway sides on either side of us, we had sea or river. And the railway lines ran down the middle of the platform. I think that's the best way I can describe it. And we detrained. And at this time, we were carrying a full pack on the back, a small pack on the side, and the kit bag on the shoulder. All our equipment with us. And wearing greatcoats. It was pretty cold. We were wearing the greatcoats to give us more room in the pack, because the kit bags were going in the hold once it got aboard. Now, I don't know how many a train carries, but there must be 700 to 1,000. And to get them on the ship was quite a slow operation. And I think we were probably 2 to 3 hours before we actually got on the ship. I think we got a cup of tea. I seem to remember somebody coming round with pots of tea. At some time during the period we were standing. But it was absolutely freezing for all it was midsummer. The Clyde's always cold as far as I'm concerned, but this was really, really freezing. There was no protection at all apart from it had a roof over. And the train came up just like a railway station with the lines down the middle of the platform. I don't know exactly. I think it was dusk when I got a ship on board anyway. The Duchess of Richmond, the Drunken Duchess, had been built in 1929 and was built for the Canadian Pacific by John Brown and Company on the Clyde. So she was in her own port, more or less. But her main route had been from Liverpool to Montreal. She was converted to a trooper in 1940. And just to carry on with the story, she was refitted again in 1946 and renamed the Empress of Canada. And went back to work again till she was burnt in 1953 in Liverpool docks. But she was a biggish boat, 590 feet, 180 metres long, 75 feet, 23 metres wide. I have a good idea of this because we used to run round it, and I think five times round it was a mile. That's going round the deck. And I think five times round it was a mile. So we're doing about 200 yards a trip round. 400 yards a trip round. That was the only bit of PT we got, really. Well, we didn't know. We had jumping horses and all the rest of it, but I'm getting away ahead again. Our billets, the MT section, were probably in the dining hall of the liner. And we had tables fitted to the floor with trestle forms either side, and there was a mess of 18 on the table, so it was like two tables joined together and then formed round each side, and the hammocks hung over the table lengthwise. The table went in sort of across the ship, but the hammocks went fore and after the ship, and you could just touch the next bloke to you and give him a good swing if you wanted to on either side, and through the night it was very often pushing each other as it went along. But B Company were in cabins. I think there'd probably been six, but in a four-berth cabin. There could have been a four-berth cabin, I don't know. And then,
how
of course,
did they get six in a four-berth
cabin? I don't know, but I'm nearly sure there was six in a four-berth cabin. Whether one was on the floor or maybe two on the floor, I don't know. But I'm nearly certain there was six. Probably somebody from B Company can give you a better idea. We didn't go to the cabins a lot. Main reason for me going was that Tom Russ, my mate, was now a corporal in B Company. He'd gone back to B Company as a corporal. He was in a cabin. And the fourth night out was my 21st. That was on the 26th of May. And beer was rationed, I think, to 2 points a man. But that wasn't strictly true, because the beer was rationed till the barrels were finished. They put so many barrels on each day, and once those barrels were finished, that was the end of the beer. And we went up to the bar with one of the big cigarette containers. Cigarettes, when they go abroad, they're packed in, like big biscuit tins. I don't know how many thousand are in a tin, but it must be quite a lot. And that would just take 2 gallons of beer. Now, if you can imagine trying to carry a big, flimsy can with 2 gallons of beer in along a corridor on a ship, when the drunken Duchess is doing a drunken bit, sort of rolling all over the place. Anyway, we got most of it to the cabin. Well, we got two in, actually. And we had quite a session. That was my 21st, the fourth night out. Somewhere off Southern Ireland, if you think, by then. I don't actually remember where we formed the convoy. But as we went further south, sort of off the Azores, it was really a marvellous sight when it was reasonably calm. But when we sort of coming together in the Irish Sea, the George, it was bigger than the Duchess of Richmond. She was our next one offside, I suppose, 100 yards away, maybe more than 100 yards. But if she went down in the hollow, we couldn't see a thing. And then we would come up on top of the crest, we'd see her down the hollow, and then we'd go down the crest, we'd see her on top of the wave. So that'll give you some idea what the sea was like just then. And another thing was that there was three of us eating 18 men's rations. All the rest, some of them came and sat down for a meal, and really hungry and ready for a meal. As soon as they saw it, they just dashed away again and left the whole lot. And there was three of us eating 18 men's rations. I suppose the cooks had pulled this down because they knew what was going to happen. But this was a good thing, because we realised then that the cure for seasickness is to keep it so they can't move, your stomach so they can't move around. Once you let it get a little bit low and it starts moving around, well, that's when the trouble seems to start. So we were very fortunate that we were eating 80 men's rations, three of us. And we got away pretty well. After 3 or 4 days, of course, they started pulling around, and then rations seemed to be a bit short until we got it sorted out.
Who was your two mates? Who
I can't remember, because Tommy shouldn't have been with me, because we used to eat by a mess, a sort of a company would eat at a time, and another company at another time. I can't remember. I think George Adams was the one, the Corporal Adams. He was the Remy Corporal. I think he was one who survived. Paddy didn't. Well, Paddy, of course, was in the sergeant's mess, so he wasn't with us at that time. And I can't think who the other one was, but those three I was eating these.
So there was quite a number of you, pretty well packed together.
Oh, yes. As I said, the hammocks were so close that you could put your hands out and touch the hammock on either side. And later on, when we got a little bit further south towards the equator, of course it was stifling, and you could feel the sweat coming from one another. And then we went upstairs and we lifted the covers off the boats and slept in the boats, the lifeboats, anywhere we could get, really, to get some sleep. There was no way you could really sleep downstairs, down in the dining hall. One thing did upset me on the ship, and because I'd taken a course where I wasn't going to get promotion, really, because empty fitters, they're generally rear echelon. As we get further on, we'll say that I spent most of my time with the air echelon, as I did with Major Jeffries. But generally speaking, you're not going to get much promotion there, and this sort of sicked me a little bit, because the sergeants, they were quite happy, they were at their own mess, and they were in their own cabins, and then of course the officers went into first class cabins and things like that, and that started to sick me a bit. But the real sickener was that there were so many chains of command. You had the captain of the ship, and then he had went through his merchant navy people, and he also had so many navy people on board with him, liaison people, and the police were navy. There was navy police on board. And then you had O.C. Ship, who was probably a colonel. It was the office, the army officer in charge of the ship. And then, unfortunately, we had brigade with us. So we had all of the brigade, which sort of take a step up from the battalion. I mean, anybody working in brigade thinks they're a step above battalion, so you've got that lot to contend with. And then our own officers and NCOs. So the chains of command really was terrific. And there wasn't much you could do about it. You just had to put up with it and hope for the best.
What were the problems that it caused?
Well, it just seemed that wherever you went, there was somebody there watching. And I've always been a bit of a freelance person. All the jobs I've done have been kind of freelance. And here I was really a number, as I found later on when I went to Remy, that you were just a number, you weren't. Before that, we'd always been a party of the regiment. But now, with so many chains of command, it just seemed as though we were really a number and dog's buddies. And that was quite good in a sense that there were certain fatigues to do. Didn't happen too often, but it was interesting because you went in the cookhouse now and again. One thing did really shake me was to go in the freezer rooms where the whole sides of beef were hanging, rows of sides of beef, and you wonder whatever's going to happen to them. And then there was the coal store that had a little bit of veg. Well, it had quite a lot of veg in when we set out, but that amazing how that got short. And then, I don't know, I think we must have lost some crew at Freetown. Well, it could have been Durban, but they were short of artificers. And there was a call for certain ones to go down, and my job was really boring, was plonking tallow in, on top of the prop shaft. On the prop shaft, you got from the centre of the ship where the engines are, you've got a prop shaft running to the tail end where the propellers are and going through and out the ship. And they had to have a block of tallow put on top of them so that if they got warm, they melted the tallow and it made a grease and allowed them to cool off again. It made an oil and allowed them to cool off again. And some were in the engine rooms, actually working in the engine rooms. I did go in the engine rooms twice. To relieve somebody, I don't know what it was about. And the crew thought a lot about us. I really got onto gin there, and a bottle of gin in there was no business, you know, it was no bother at all. Which again was a good thing, because later on the Red Sea, we lost about five men through drinking iced water. Well, if you had a drop of gin in the water, you put the things in that the ice had taken out, so it helped a lot. So we had a good tour on the ship. One thing really did astound me were the staircases, which we didn't use a lot because that was sort of in the first class areas. But in the first class areas, the staircases, they were really magnificent. And there was a ballroom, and we used to have concerts in there. And the ship's crew, they had a permanent concert party out to their own crew, and we would supply so many, and the band would do so many things. Ran out on concert party, did one or two shows.
What was the food like?
The food was good once we got sorted out into who was going to eat and who wasn't going to eat. And eventually, when everybody got the sea legs, of course, the food increased, and there was just this spell where people started coming back, and then there was a bit of a shortage. But after that, everything they got on the sea legs, they were quite good. And they had their own caterers, the ship's crew, doing the cooking. And the kitchens were really marvellous. As a boy of 10, I was in the ship, in the kitchens of the Olympic, which was slightly bigger again than the Duchess of Richmond. But they again, so I had an idea, but kitchens, they really were terrific and spotlessly clean. One or two bits of snags, and I don't know how they arose, but I had to go forward once where the chains are for the anchors. And up there, I come across this great big matelow. Oh, he was a big fella, and he had this half a pickaxe in his hand. And there were the cages and the blokes in chains. I don't know why they were there. But it's frightening when you see them.
There was actually people in there?
In there, yes. I don't know what the problem was.
They weren't army, were they?
Some were army. Some were army, some were the crew, some were navy. I don't know what the cases had been, but yes, so they were there.
And they were actually locked in chains, did you say?
In chains, some of them, yes. Yeah, there was no... he was a monster, this. One of the best men I've seen. And, you know, a navy uniform with gaiters on, it's really it's frightening. Much more than an army is with... Although maybe I'm used to the army with gaiters on, I don't know. But to see a navy man with the gaiters on and his boots, which you don't often see, he was a massive, and he had this truncheon in his hand about 2 feet long. I was glad to get away.
How did you counteract the boredom of the journey?
Well, we used to look forward to our beer ration, and we played cards a lot. There was, through the day, there was always a boat drill. Every day, I should think, was a boat drill, or every other day, anyway. Well, that was part of the routine to keep us from getting bored, or not, I don't know, but it got a bit sickening towards the end. The boat drill, and we used to have this run round the decks. There was deck kites. Most ship things. There was quite a lot of room on deck, really, for all those so many hours, because there was lecture. Mike Lockhart, he did a lecture every week on how to use vehicles and crossing country and maintenance and what could expect when we got wherever we were going to. We didn't know at that time where we were going.
You were getting talks from people who would tell you about the desert?
About the desert.
What to do and what not to do.
Yes. Of course, we could easily have gone to Ethiopia. We weren't forced to go to the desert, which was a different type of land altogether. It could have been Ethiopia, it could have been Somaliland, it could easily have been Iraq, which
was
Iraq. What
kind of things were they raising in the lecture? What kind of points were they making?
Well, mainly on maintenance and tactics, formations, different formations and tactics and aircraft spotting. They did a shoot once off the side of the ship, threw some cans over the side, and they did a shoot, rifle shoot, stripping brand guns, stripping the boys' rifle, stripping the rifle as well. But the arms were taken from us. We didn't keep our arms. We didn't keep our kit bags. They were all taken from us and stored. Which is probably a sensible thing when you think about the heat that you're going to go through, not to have people with arms around. There was certainly no ammunition. There was the odd brand gun that was around for drill purposes, and the odd rifle for drill purposes. I think there was a guard somewhere. I don't know where, but I'm nearly sure there was a guard or a picket, a night picket. I don't know why that was. I never fell for that one.
So what were you basically doing on the ship during the course of the time?
Well, apart from doing these jobs for the crew, and that too was more or less all the way through, any spare time we had, we were doing lectures and the things. It was sort of to work out, so there might be three or maybe four of us doing the job, like putting the tallow on. And it would be alternated, so we fit a lecture in each day and maybe some sport each day and some free time each day. One thing that did, another thing that shook me was getting to know the crew, was to see how pale they were. They weren't just pale, they were white, because they hardly ever came on deck. I suppose some of them, they never came on deck. A lot of them, you could see them hanging over the side, just filling their lungs up with fresh air. But I think a lot of them, they never came up at all, and they were just like paper white, not just pale. They had no colour at all. And that I often wondered about that. You know, it was strange for me to see anybody in that sort of state. I suppose they lost quite a lot through perspiration and that.
Was there much illness?
Not that I can recall on the ship. No, I suppose there was some, but I can't. I can't recall anything much apart from the seasickness we had at the start, which you just cure yourself. There's no. I don't think anybody's got a cure for it really yet. Certainly there was no tablets that I'm aware of at that time. There might have been, but I'm not aware of any. And I suppose if some of them went on with the sickness 4 or 5 days, then they were dealt with. But most of them came back after about 3 days.
The situation didn't get worse as you got to the pilots?
I don't think so, no. When we got to Freetown, the little boats came around, and we all bought limes. It was the first time I'd seen limes. There weren't hardly saw limes in this country, for all being in the greengrocery business a little bit. They'd never seen any limes. And there was limes and oranges, bananas, which we hadn't seen for a long time, mangoes, and we bought quantities of these, and you had to haggle a little bit because the boat was down at the bottom, and there was nothing came up till the money went down. The money had to go down before anything came up, and you weren't quite sure what was going to go up after you put your money down. And again, we couldn't get on very well with the language. You had to sort of point and say, yes, how much is that? And I don't know what money we had. I suppose we used some I don't know what money it was. Anyway, we bought some limes and got some fresh fruit at least. And the ship took on quantities of vegetables and fruit.
Were you in Freetown long?
I think we're there probably about 4 days. But we weren't ashore. We weren't ashore at all, and there was no way we'd get ashore because the ship was way out from the shore. Or possibly 200 yards or maybe more from the shore. So there was no way we were going to get ashore or anybody like that. Everything was done by lighters and these little boats that came out. We did have one scare there. An enemy aircraft came across. I don't know where it came from or what it belonged to. But certainly fired a few shots just to let us know that the war was still on. And I think it was somewhere between Gourock and Freetown that we heard that Hitler attacked Russia. And that was a queer situation because Russia had always been the enemy. And when it went in with, signed a pact with Germany, was even greater enemy. And the next thing we know is that Hitler's attacked Russia. It was really took some understanding. In fact, I don't think we ever did understand it. But there was some joy about this because Hitler had sort of gone off onto another side, and it meant that he couldn't put all his forces against us. But we never really got round to the problem. And of course, much later on, when everything was going to Russia instead of going in the desert, then we really got a bit upset about it. I think somewhere, I don't know whether it was before Freetown or just after Freetown, the Exeter left us. We started off with a big escort. And then we seemed to get down to about one, just the Exeter. Then she left us somewhere, and we were on paddling on our own canoe as far as we could see. There was no sign of any escort at all. And I think this was probably the Graspey, would it be? About that time? Anyway, they went off to in search of one of these, or maybe two of these battleships that had escaped from the fjords. Now, the Exeter came back, and she was stationed between us and the Georgic then, sort of in the centre of the convoy, which is unusual for an escort to be there, but I suppose she was trying to keep pace and control of the convoy from the centre. And one day, her Albatross came back, the aeroplane from her, the Albatross flying boat, and got alongside the Exeter, and then just flopped in the sea. And we knew there was some sort of commotion, and the day after we heard that the pilot had died, where he'd been shot, and he just got back and died, or he died through the bad landing, and he just seemed to drop out the sky. He was about level with the mast of the Exeter, and suddenly he just dropped out the sky. So whether he'd been away hunting and been shot or not, we never found out, but anyway, he died. And we sort of watched the burial at sea from where we were. Well, we had a kind of a service along the side of the ship, and he was pushed over the side. And that was the first burial at sea I'd seen. No idea why it happened, but it was a saddening thing, because we knew something had been on, and we were all depressed.
What was discipline like on the ship, particularly as you got close together and you were getting into quite hot conditions?
It wasn't too bad, but tempers were starting to fray because we're so close together. Tempers were starting to fray. I don't recall a lot of problems, but as I have said, there were some problems where people were put in irons because they'd been violent or disobeyed some orders anyway. But there's so many T's of command that they really upset people, because you couldn't sort of look anywhere without there's somebody watching you. And if you're in a confined space, it's even worse. You can't go anywhere without being watched. Russie and I, we did start it's condemned in the Navy, Crown Anchor. One of the crew gave me a Crown Anchor board. We went up and we done quite good business with the Crown Anchor board. The RSM got wind of it, says, any gambling on here, I want to be in it, and he took it off us.
So it was an offence to gamble?
Crown Anchor was an offence, yeah. I don't know why, but it's an offence in the Navy as far as I suppose the stakes get too high, and they weren't. It was illegal as far as they were concerned, and that was the end of the Crown Anchor. But we had quite a good deal at where it was going.
So from Freetown, where did you get after that?
Straight down the. Well, saying straight down, we cut straight down to past the Cape of Good Hope. Yeah, Cape of Good Hope. Cape Town. And we could see Cape Town as we went past in the Roaring Forties. And down there, an amazing thing was seeing the phosphorus in the sea. As we were going along, you could see all these sparkles, phosphorus sparking in the sea as we went along. And also the flying fish. And there was the albatross followed us for a long way, which the Navy was always kidding us up. This was a very bad sign for the albatross to follow us. Maybe it was, because we lost the five lads on the Red Sea through lack of salt. So maybe it was a bad sign, I don't know. But we had no trouble, really, until we got in. We had no trouble. The next port was Durban. Now, it's funny, but we crossed the equator, of course, which was quite a...
You'd have a ceremony.
Quite a ceremony, yes. quite a few docking stools and one thing and another. I don't recall much in between the Freetown and apart from our normal chores and lectures.